Roughly Speaking with Dan Rodericks is brought to you by the Ivy Bookshop. The Ivy stocks a wide selection of books covering Baltimore and the Chesapeake Bay region, many by local authors. Located at 6080 Falls Road, more information can be found at theivybookshop.com.
Hello again from the Baltimore Sun. Dan Rodericks here, Baltimore Sun columnist and host of Roughly Speaking. This is episode 337 for the 21st day of December, 2017. In the last of a series of introductory interviews with Democratic candidates for governor of Maryland, today we meet Maya Rocky Moore Cummings, a public policy expert and one of two women seeking their party's nomination. A one-time congressional staffer and congressional chief of staff, Maya Rocky Moore Cummings is the founder of Global Policy Solutions, a Washington-based consulting company. She is the wife of Representative Elijah Cummings, the veteran congressman from Baltimore. Rocky Moore Cummings wants to be the Democrat who challenges incumbent Republican Larry Hogan because, she says, Hogan has a limited vision for the state and has held back economic development for Baltimore by killing the Red Line light rail project and the State Center redevelopment. She says she has a plan for, quote, inclusive growth that will address what she calls high levels of inequality across Maryland. Maya Rocky Moore Cummings, it's a pleasure to meet you. Thanks for being here.
It's a pleasure to be with you.
Why are you running for governor?
I wasn't hearing the message that I wanted to hear from the candidates in the race. I think that we have high levels of inequality across the state, from the Eastern Shore to Western Maryland, Baltimore City, and pockets in between. And frankly, there's not a lot happening from the governor's side in terms of addressing these issues. And so I'm coming at this from an inclusive growth perspective, that we need to actually boost our economy while also addressing inequality in a way that results in broadly shared prosperity across the state. We can do it. There is a win-win strategy, and I'm offering that in terms of my platform for this campaign. And so excellent education is a priority, boosting the economy, particularly with a focus on small businesses that can drive job creation, and making sure that our working families have the supports that they need in order to thrive.
So let's get to know you a little bit. Where did you grow up?
So nowhere and everywhere.
You must have been in a military family. Let me guess.
I was.
Okay.
So, you know, my story is I'm the fourth generation from slavery. My folks grew up in the Jim Crow South, and my dad was, you know, he went into the military during the Vietnam War era, and so by the time I was born, he was already in. I lived everywhere. By the time I graduated from high school, I lived in 9 different places across the country, and we even lived abroad. And so when people ask you where you're from, that is a conundrum for people who are military brats like I was.
When you look back on that, what do you take away from it? You know, moving in and out of schools, moving so much, or did you have a good time with
it? It becomes a way of life. I mean, I'm fascinated by people who have known people from kindergarten.
Well, that happens a lot around Baltimore.
Yes. I mean, you know, it's my spouse. You know, he's a homegrown Baltimorean. And, you know, to run into people in the grocery store who you knew in first grade, that is amazing. Amazing to me. But the fact of the matter is, it becomes a way of life. You get used to moving every 2 years. You get used to meeting people of all different backgrounds, all walks of life, all different kinds of, you know, perspectives on the world. And so it becomes a habit, if you will, in terms of moving in and out of different kinds of social environments and understanding how people kind of organize themselves in similar ways across places and spaces.
Where did your mom come from? Where did your dad come from? Where were they as kids?
They literally grew up next door to each other in a small West Texas town called Paducah. It's in the panhandle of Texas. And literally, to give you a sense of what this town was like, it was the Jim Crow South. You know, I grew up with stories of my parents telling us that about how they had to go upstairs to the separate space for the black kids in the movie theater, how they had to go find, if they had to use the restroom, they had to leave the movie theater to go across the street to the basement of the courthouse to use the restroom that was designated for Negroes, or to drink out of the water fountain designated for Negroes. And to give you a sense of what that place is like now, the median income is $21,000. And so this is a desperately poor place. My parents, you know, in their families picked cotton when they were young. But, you know, the first chance they got, they left. And they traveled the world with the military. And so my brother, sister, and I had a very different upbringing. We had a life that was extremely different. You know, we saw the promise and the potential of what America is and can be from the perspective of diversity and inclusion. In many ways, we lived Martin Luther King's dream to the extent that, you know, we went to schools that were good. We had health care, we had dental care, we had, you know, affordable housing. And these are the things that we want for Marylanders. These are the things we want for the nation. And so, you know, I feel very strongly and passionately about this, that these are the things that we need to pursue to give every young person in this state an opportunity to get a good start in life and to live up to their fullest potential.
By the time you were in high school, where did your family live? Where did you graduate from high school?
Yeah, so he retired when I was in high school in San Antonio, Texas. And so that's where I graduated.
And college?
Undergrad, Prairie View A&M University, which is a historically—
Also in Texas, right?
A historically black college in Texas. Used to be a plantation. It's about 90 miles north of Houston. It's a part of the Texas A&M system. And from there, I went to Purdue University to earn both my master's and my PhD. I have a PhD in political science, but we were required to have four areas of emphasis. And so my areas were American politics, public policy, international relations, and African American studies.
What got you interested in politics?
You know, traveling all over the place, you were able to see different outcomes for different people. And I began to, you know, there was a disconnect for me, you know, coming back to where my parents were from and seeing, you know, the desperate poverty, particularly on one side of town where the, you know, all of a sudden the pavement stops and people don't have indoor plumbing and, you know, you just got houses that are falling down. And then going around the world and around the United States and seeing how, you know, other people lived wondering and trying to figure out what these differences were. And it led me to politics and policy to understand, you know, how to use the levers of government and the levers of public policy in order to make a difference so that we don't have these deep levels of inequality and disparities based on, you know, factors, whether that be race, whether that be income, whatever you want to call, you know, the variables that are creating differences between us. We need to have opportunities for everyone to have, you know, the best chance at life in this country and in this state. And so that's what I'm focused on.
Tell us about your career after college. I know you went to Washington. I know you worked in Congress.
I did. So I came to Washington in 1997. I was trying to figure out how to afford to get to Washington to collect data for my dissertation, which was on the African-American political response to HIV/AIDS. And so I applied for and won a Congressional Black Caucus Foundation Fellowship. I arrived in Washington in 1997, and I was assigned to the office of former Congressman Mel Watt. And I was a legislative fellow in his office. That was a 9-month gig. But before, in that place and space, I actually worked as a real legislative aide, working on issues like Social Security and health care. And during the course of my time at that fellowship placement, I ran into a woman who worked on the Social Security Subcommittee of the House Ways and Means Committee. And she invited me towards the end of my fellowship to join the permanent staff, the professional staff of the House Ways and Means Committee, Social Security Subcommittee, which I did. And so that led me on a completely different trajectory. I decided to put off, you know, finishing my dissertation.
You went into Social Security policy and law?
I did.
Well, George Bush became president in 2001 and talked about privatizing Social Security. Were you around during that time?
So it was my job when I worked on the House Ways and Means Committee to actually push back against the privatizers.
So you were there at that time.
It was during the early days where, the Republicans were pushing this agenda. And so I had to educate members of Congress on the House side about what privatization meant for women, for people of color, for, you know, people of all backgrounds. I published Dear Colleagues that went out under, you know, the ranking member's name, et cetera. I would brief members of Congress on these issues. And it was also my job to pull together the coalition that eventually went on to expand and defeat President George W. Bush's efforts to privatize Social Security in 2005. Because remember, when he won re-election in 2004, the first thing that he declared after his victory was that he was going to work on privatization of Social Security. I had always wondered why God was telling me to learn all this stuff about Social Security. Once George W. Bush did that, I was all across the country educating union members, teachers, people all across the country about what privatization meant. And we were able to defeat a sitting president of the United States at that proposal.
Do you think that will come back, that
yes.
idea? The Republicans have passed this big tax overhaul. It looks like an attempt to further starve the beast, so to speak, of government, so that in a year, 2 years, maybe they can start talking about cutting entitlements, maybe even Social Security.
I don't even think they're going to wait that long. The bill is even more pernicious than that, because all of us are paying for those. We're paying for those subsidies for people who don't need our subsidies. This is just egregious, I mean, in terms of what this bill does, not just to people in households, but to states, to institutions like universities, to public schools. You name it, there is not an entity out there that won't be negatively affected by this bill. But to get to your point, you know, they're willing to actually add to the deficit $1.5 trillion, and then they're going to come back. It's a ruse. They're going to come back and they're going to say, oh, now we can't afford Social Security or Medicare or Medicaid, which is just, to me, completely insane and inhumane.
You're a Democrat. You want the Democratic nomination for governor. What makes you a Democrat? What do you think defines the Democratic Party?
I believe that we believe the role of government is to set a standard of living in this country beneath which a human being should not fall. So when you look at the pillars of progress of the 20th century, they were done by Democrats. If we're talking about the Social Security Act of 1935, if we're talking about the Voting Rights Act, if we're talking about, you know, the creation of Medicare and Medicaid, all of these programs are pillars of progress. They have enhanced our quality of life as Americans. They have created a standard of living that we have become accustomed to. They have defined how we actually leverage the role of government to improve the lives of people so that our economy can be more productive and our people can have a good quality of life and that their children can have an even better quality of life. That is what Democrats stand for. And so, unfortunately, we are up against a party that does not believe that. They believe that there should be no role of a legitimate role of government in public life in a major way. They believe that by minimizing the role of government, you can actually enhance the role of the private sector. But, you know, and when you take that to its logical end in terms of how they view it, it's a push to privatize all public functions and to actually turn over the common good to the private sector, which means that every aspect of our lives would be monetized, from the air we breathe to the, you know, to anything that, you know, we're talking about freeways. They're trying to do away with freeways. You know, tolls are just the beginning. Literally, they're talking about monetizing, you know, all aspects of the driving experience.
You mean we'll have freeways, they just won't be free.
They won't be free.
And one more question about national politics, and then we'll get into why you're running for governor. How do you explain Trump?
I think now we're coming to realize that the Russians played a greater role than we ever thought. And so I do think that, you know, I question whether, you know, we have a legitimate president, actually. That being said, you know, the role of misogyny and racism and certainly the fear of immigrants and, you know, the fear of Muslims. I mean, he literally divided the country and conquered in the process. And so, you know, it's really sad because, as you well know, we have a very diverse nation. He was playing different population groups against each other. Ultimately, I think, for a very narrow vision of a future that is looking to, I think, return the nation to at least a pre-1950s state, if not even earlier. And so in many ways, you know, that radicalized me because I truly believe that his agenda and the agenda of the Republicans in Congress and even across the country is to take us back at least 100 years. It's depressing. It's sad. I mean, because, you know, I think that we've made significant strides through most of the 20th century and certainly I think the early part of this century towards building that diverse and inclusive economy. And our trajectory has been always one, I think, of moving towards a more perfect union. And so to know that there is, a strain of folks in this country, as epitomized by this leader and certainly his followers, that are willing to basically destroy all of that progress in the name of...
What? In the name of what?
I think that they romanticize a past where they had an advantage that was socially constructed and also reinforced by the institutions that they were able to shape. And that advantage was, you know, artificially constructed to the extent that it was rigged through the system, and they're seeking to recapture that.
So in light of that, if you were to become governor of Maryland, what do you think you'd have to do here in order for the state to stay on a progressive track while you have a regressive government in Washington?
So I think that's what's exciting about what I call my inclusive growth strategy. Inclusive growth strategy, that we can literally build our economy from the bottom up and the middle out. We're leaving too much talent on the table. We're leaving too many people behind. Too many young people don't have an on-ramp into our economy. And that's simply unacceptable. What do we gain by making sure that there are people being warehoused who don't have, who are not able to develop their talents so that they can be fully productive in our economy?
You're talking about the
Maryland.
Incarcerated population?
Incarcerated population, or young people on the west side of Baltimore mm-hmm. who have no opportunities that are economically connected to our city, our region, or our state. You know, they don't have to be incarcerated. They might be sitting in mom's house. And what does that gain? What do we get out of that? That means that we're our economy is underproducing. And so what I'm arguing is that by making sure that we're having on-ramps and opportunities for people to be fully productive in our economy, we all benefit. We all benefit. Because what we're doing is we're growing our economy.
Where are those on-ramps? Community colleges, high schools, colleges, where is that what you're talking
above.
About, education?
All of the above. When I say excellent education, regardless of zip code, there's once you dive down, there is an objective there. And the ultimate objective is to make sure that not only that our young people have mastery of the basic skills that they need in order to be successful in life and in their career, but that we are deliberate and intentional about connecting them to our economy, whether they go through a 2-year college process, a 4-year college process, or no college at all. We need to actually expand career and technical education across the state, deliberately linking them to opportunities that might be apprenticeship programs, they might be certification programs, but no young person should graduate from any institution, any high school in this state, without having a marketable skill that allows them to connect to, an economic opportunity. And if they end up going to a college setting, you know, making sure that those colleges are enhancing their prospects for having and developing a career that's connected to opportunities, whether they be jobs that exist or jobs of the future, that we're being deliberate and intentional about coordinating our economy with our educational system and making sure that the products of our educational system are fitting within our economy and helping to drive and grow it.
What were you thinking at the time you decided to run for governor? You say Trump really radicalized you this past year, but what was it? What were you thinking at the time you said, you know, Maya, I think you ought to run for governor?
Yeah, and Hogan has radicalized me. And so, interestingly enough, you know, he has been a governor for some of the people, but not all the people, and he has absolutely mistreated Baltimore. In fact, I argue that he's underdeveloped Baltimore. He came right in and he snatched the red line, gave the feds back their money. That was hard. I mean, that was a lot of hard work by a lot of different groups, a lot of different stakeholders that he just dumped. You know, what would have come with it was transit-oriented development, which would have developed many places on the west side.
On the west side of Baltimore.
Yeah. This is where I live.
I know.
And so, you know.
I'm glad you mentioned that because a lot of the gripes came from the southeast side of the city, you know,
right.
Canton and Fells Point and downtown. If people didn't think about what about the rest of the line that travels from, you know, Woodlawn through the west side, Edmondson Avenue and into the city on the west side.
That is lost tax revenue. That means that all of those areas that you pass through in your car, maybe going out Route 40 or whatever, all of those empty buildings, all of those, empty homes. I mean, that the potential of using the transit-oriented development strategy to boost economic development on the West Side would have been huge. And by undermining the Red Line, that in and of itself, not just talking about, preventing people from getting to work, and having more opportunities economically in terms of getting them to their destinations. I'm talking about the transit-oriented development part of it. And he underdeveloped Baltimore in the process.
And then there's State Center.
State Center is the gateway to the West Side. And I don't know where these folks are coming from who say, first of all, people know, I'm sure your listeners know, that they've locked it up in litigation and the red herring strategies of, this adding more stadiums to the city. And, I mean, all of that is red herring, meaning that...
Or a sports arena.
A sports...
Yeah, Peter Franchot at the last minute said, why don't we put a sports arena
that
at State
kills
Center.
Economic yeah. development for the West Side, because as you well know, all you have around sports arenas are parking lots that are unproductive. So my question is, what do they have against the development of the West Side of the city? Why are they playing into this? We have lopsided development in Baltimore City. It is inequitable, unequitable. It is, it is a situation that is deliberately undermining the economic development of an entire portion of our city. And that is simply unacceptable. And so what we lose from that is, again, revenue. We have our tax base is still, as you well know, since the 1960s, struggling to meet and service the needs of our residents and our homeowners in terms of our services. And so, what we need to do is we need to develop the city equitably. We need to make sure that all parts of the city have an opportunity to participate in an economic development strategy that will uplift the economy of all parts of the city and therefore drive more tax revenue into our coffers to make us better able to support the improvements that we need across the city. And yet we have, politicians like Governor Larry Hogan who have stood in the way of that happening. And the question becomes why?
Well, you're not running for mayor, you're running for governor. He didn't run for mayor, he ran for governor. And there are other people in the suburbs and rural areas who actually have no interest in Baltimore City.
Let me tell them something if they're listening. I don't care where you are in the state, but while I've started traveling around and talking to people, there's a common complaint, and I've heard it in Montgomery County, and I've heard it elsewhere, that we produce revenue and we send it to the state, and we just get back a paltry sum in terms of the money that we contribute. And the implication is always that Baltimore is siphoning our money, that we're basically subsidizing Baltimore so much that we can't have our revenue back and it can't enhance the living conditions and the services we provide in our own counties. Well, that means that you have a vested interest in making sure that Baltimore does well, because when Baltimore does well, that means you get to keep more of your tax dollars and have it go towards enhancements in your county. So there is no reason why anybody else in the state should take the attitude that, that they don't care about Baltimore City, because Baltimore City is an asset that needs to be fully developed. And so as long as we have people like Larry Hogan who view it as a deficit, or a campaign prop, or something to be kicked so he can run his numbers up with his base, then we will never get to where we need to be. I will be the governor that views Baltimore as an asset, who has a specific plan for how to develop this city in a way that drives the economic base of the entire state.
So you would revive the Red Line for one thing?
I don't think that it will ever come back in the way it was originally conceptualized. I do think we will rebuild transit, but it's going to cost more than it would have if we would have gotten it done 3 years ago. And I do think that the shape of it will probably be different, because I think if I'm, in charge, and I plan to be, I do think that we need to be thinking more imaginatively about transit in this not just the city or the region, but the entire state. There is an opportunity, I think, to think about what 21st century transit system looks like for the state of Maryland. And that's moving people from their locations to where the jobs are. And it's thinking about it, I think, on a statewide basis and definitely a regional basis. And so with that, I do think there's an opportunity to reimagine what that looks like.
Maryland had the rap of being unfriendly to business. The governor planted on signs welcoming people into Maryland, "We're open for business," as if we hadn't been before. But anyway, the state seems to have this reputation of being business unfriendly, yet I see lots of thriving businesses here and lots of millionaires who live in our state. Do you agree with that assessment about Maryland and that we need to go further to being open for business?
I think that we need to do more to develop our economy. I think we need to do more in terms of creating an innovation sector. There's no reason why we shouldn't be known for industry that's focused on cyber security and technology, having, entire corridors that are created that focus on not just research and development, but also technology, innovation-focused industry. And we're not there, not in the way that we need to be. And so Virginia has developed it more than Maryland has developed it. In fact, there is a census document that I read that showed that comparatively speaking, we're actually on par with states like Alabama and Mississippi in terms of business development and opportunity. And that states like Delaware and even D.C. are doing better than we are. Mm. And so, we have a lot of work to do. And Governor Hogan, while he is, I think, attempted to drive that train, I think that, there's more that needs to be done.
We're closing out the year here, 2017, in Baltimore City, another year of violence and crime, and been another tough year here. What do you think the governor's role could be in helping Baltimore City in that regard?
The governor needs to be a partner. He needs to quit using the city as a campaign prop when it comes to crime. Crime has gone up under the governor's watch. And instead of, and he literally within the last 2 weeks came up with a quote-unquote crime plan. And yet he's been the governor for 3 years, and he's watched all of this happen. And so with that, I can't help but be cynical because the plan that he offered, and I say plan in quotes, not trying to be funny, but just being real, is not a crime prevention strategy. It's a straight up incarceration strategy. Without the prevention side. And so as far as I'm concerned, there was nothing in there that was focused on prevention. He'll point to the fact that he was offering more money to demolish abandoned homes. But even that, I think, is something that is not, effective or efficient to get to the issue here.
Have you thought about how you would partner with the city? Like, what specifically, is there a specific idea you would throw in?
So none of these are separate from each other. Having an excellent education system is a part of having a good crime prevention plan. Having equitable economic development across the city so that we have jobs across the city is a part of a crime prevention plan. Making sure that our neighborhood environments are actually healthy and livable. As you well know, I don't know if you do know, but lead poisoning is a problem. And the research on lead poisoning shows that it leads to violence. And so, to look at primary prevention aspects of this and make the investments on the front end so that we're actually not just talking about policing, but we're also talking about investments on the front end, that is a true crime prevention plan that's holistic and that will get us to where we need to be to reduce crime and provide more opportunities across the city.
So someone may ask this question, why should I change? Hogan, he seems to be okay. He didn't raise my taxes. He cut the highway tolls. He's fixing the roads. He shortened the school year back so that school begins after Labor Day now. Those things seem okay to me. Why should I change? I know he's a Republican, but, he's not really Trump.
And actually, I'm running into people who are saying that, and yeah. Some of them are Democrats. And mm-hmm. So I offer them this. If Hogan gets a second term, he will be in charge during the redistricting process, and he will change, he will flip at least 2 to 3 House seats at the federal level from Democrat to Republican, giving federal Republicans an even further advantage in terms of their hold on the Congress. And he will change the character and the nature of the state house in a way that does not reflect the values of this state, I believe. He is already working on this plan. He has announced that, he is trying to get this veto-proof Senate where he's running a strategy against 6 senators so that he can try to, get more Republicans in those seats and then get a veto-proof so that if he gets a second term and he has a plan for redistricting, he can just ram it through. And this means that all of those Democrats who think that he's been okay absolutely allowed, you know, the fox in the hen house and ultimately undermine, if that happens, they are ultimately undermining, I think, the natural tendency of the state, which I think is, of course, trending blue, not red. They will single-handedly have handed National Republicans what they consider, I think, a very important crown jewel, which is the state of Maryland. And we can't let that happen. We can do better. If your crowning achievement is making sure that kids lose their learning over the summer by extending the summer months so that, you know, that they can have vacation on, you know, on the Eastern Shore, go out to Ocean City.
On Labor Day weekend.
You know, if you think that that's a success, if you think that a successful governor is one who reduces tolls and does nothing else, if you think a successful governor is one who has been anti-women's health, anti-public education, anti-environment, anti-working families.
How has he been anti-public education, if you don't mind the interruption?
Yeah, so, you know, he has continuously tried to, I think, stand in the way of making sure that kids who need the budgets and the allocations that they need in order to have a quality education have gotten that. He has tried to push an agenda to, you know, of course, expand and get control at the state level of the charters so that he can have more influence over, the charter system in this country, in this state, and to actually, expand those. He has also failed to sign the federal waiver for the Title I schools in a way that could, you know, potentially undermine funding at the federal level for these very low income, struggling schools. And so, you know, to me, that is not what a governor should do who cares about children in public education. He has been anti-public education, and he's been anti-voting rights. Like, we can't forget that he allowed a high-ranking official in his administration to sit on the Pence-Kobach Commission, or otherwise known, I call, the Trump Voter Suppression Commission. Even though it was for just a short time, the fact that, you know, this man was authorized to sit on that commission and even sent off with Hogan's chief of staff saying, you know, do us proud. You know, this is a known commission that's seeking to repress the vote. And so, you know, we deserve better.
Just one question about your husband, Elijah Cummings, Congressman Cummings. Did you tell him you were running for governor, or did you ask him whether you should?
So we contemplated it and had a conversation, several conversations about what to do. And I got to tell you that I spent the summer contemplating it because, many people are asked why I got in so late. My spouse was in Johns Hopkins for the majority of the summer, and so I was with him, literally spending almost all of those 60 days and nights with him by his side as he recovered. That being said, you know, we ultimately came to a decision and a conclusion that this was something that we should and could do.
Someone might ask, why not run for city council? Why not get started someplace else? House of Delegates, Maryland Senate. Why governor?
So I argue that I have spent the last 20 years of my professional career in executive leadership roles. And when I look back on my experiences, I have literally been preparing for this opportunity all of my professional career. I have done trade policy, I have done technology policy, I have done healthcare policy, I have done education policy. I have worked with policymakers at every level of government, and on the executive side and on the legislative side. I've worked at the local, the county level, and at this and at the federal level. I know how to move policy. I've been at the forefront of efforts to protect and expand Social Security, which has helped Marylanders. I helped launch the 10,000 Small Businesses Here program here in Baltimore City. I have helped to make sure that our young people across the state of Maryland have healthier opportunities for nutritious food in schools and also more opportunities to be physically active in communities. And so I have done a lot of work, had a lot of different experiences that make me, I think, uniquely qualified for this position.
Maya Rocky Moore Cummings, thank you very much.
Thank you. I've enjoyed it.
Maryland Democratic gubernatorial candidate Maya Rocky Moore Cummings is a longtime public policy expert, one-time congressional staffer and congressional chief of staff, and the founder of Global Policy Solutions, a Washington-based consulting company. She lives in Baltimore with her husband, Representative Elijah Cummings. She is the 8th Democratic candidate to sit for a Roughly Speaking interview. You can access all previous interviews by visiting the podcast Candidates page. There's a link to it in the notes with this podcast. We plan a second round of interviews for 2018 ahead of Maryland's June primary, and we've invited Governor Hogan to the studio. That's our show for now. For producers Steve Early and Quinn Kelly, I'm Dan Rodericks. Thanks for listening to Roughly Speaking. See you again soon. Merry Christmas and Happy Holidays.
Roughly Speaking with Dan Rodericks is brought to you by the Ivy Bookshop, an independent bookstore at Falls Road and Lake Avenue in Baltimore. The Ivy stocks a wide selection of books covering Baltimore and the Chesapeake Bay region, many by local authors. Located at 6080 Falls Road, more information can be found at theivybookshop.com or by calling 410-377-2966.